Welcome back, True Crime Army. I am your host, Margot, and this is Military Murder, a show where I focus on crimes committed by military members and veterans. But don't worry, you don't have to know anything about the military to listen, I promise. You just have to be a true crime enthusiast, and if that's you, welcome home. Today's case was recommended by way of listener suggestion, which is how I come across most of my cases nowadays. And when I looked this case up, I thought, what an odd case. If you've ever spoken to anyone who had to go through one trial, either as a witness or a victim, you know it's a lot. But what are your thoughts on someone going through five trials in a double homicide witnessed by three young children? Well, hold your pants, because today's story will be sure to raise your anxiety levels. But on top of that, this case might leave you wondering, why was the initial investigation so sloppy? What was the 911 dispatcher thinking? And did it really require five trials to get a resolution? Join me today as I tell you about the five trials of Sergeant Brent Burke out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and the double homicide of Tracy Burke and Karen Comer. Now, let's dig in.
Military Murder is an independent project and is not endorsed by the Department of Defense or any military component. The views expressed are those of the host. The content of this podcast is not meant to be legal or medical advice. Warning, this episode contains graphic details of murder and is not suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Our story today begins on the morning of September 11th, 2007 in Rhineyville, Kentucky, when 911 dispatchers received a call from 9-year-old Matthew Pete.
911.
Somebody broke into our house last night, and I don't know who it was, but they killed everybody here except for my sister, my brother, and me.
Okay, and what happened now?
There was a guy with a pistol or some kind of gun, and he came in and shot my mother and my grandma. Those were the only ones here.
And you're there now?
And they also killed one of my grandma's dogs, so we still have three dogs left.
Did you just now come home?
No.
Were you there last night?
Yes. I was just afraid to call.
Stay on the line, okay? I'm going to take you to the police department.
Okay.
Kentucky State Police, 911.
Yes, there was a break-in that last night. I was afraid to call, and they shot the only two people here, which was my grandma and my mom.
In what county?
Rhineyville, Kentucky.
In Rhineyville?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on right now?
Nothing. I was just afraid to call, last night.
Okay, and did the police come out last night?
No.
They didn't?
No.
And who was shot last night?
My mom and my grandma.
Your mom and grandma?
Yes. And one of my grandma's dogs. The only people here are me, my sister, and my brother.
How old is your sister and your brother?
My sister's a few months old. My brother's only just four.
How old are you?
I'm nine.
Where were they taken last night? Did the police come?
No, they weren't taken. They were shot in my house.
Okay. And did they go to the doctor?
No.
Where are they at right now?
They're dead in my house. There's blood splattered everywhere.
Do you know who done this?
No.
You don't know? And you've been there all night by yourself?
Yes, with my brother and sister.
Okay, honey. You stay on the line, okay?
Okay.
After the 911 call, the Kentucky State Police, that I will refer to as KSP, responded to the crime scene that only can be described as a house of horrors. Authorities determined that the intruder made entry into the home through the back door by shooting the back door glass window and unlocking the door from the inside. Inside, they found Matthew's 53-year-old grandmother, Karen Comer, dead in the kitchen. And in a back bedroom, they found Matthew's 31-year-old mother, Tracy Burke. Heartbreakingly, inside the home and still hiding, authorities found Matthew and his two young siblings. Matthew told authorities that when the shooting took place, he could hear his grandmother screaming that she was dying. In thinking about the investigation and death notifications, investigators learned that Tracy Burke had three children. Matthew Pete, the 9-year-old that made the 911 phone call, was Tracy's son with her first husband, Michael Pete. Michael Pete was also in the Army. Tracy and Michael were divorced, and Tracy married another soldier by the name of Sergeant Brent Burke. Together, Tracy and Brent had two kids, but they were in the process of getting divorced. Tracy, during this process, Tracy asked her first husband's family for help, and Tracy and her kids were temporarily staying with Michael's parents, Karen and Kurt Comer. Kurt was a long-distance truck driver, and he was not at home when the double homicide took place. So if you're tracking, Tracy, the wife, the military spouse, was staying with her former in-laws. Tracy's estranged husband, Brent Burke, was stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, as a military policeman at the time of the murders, and that was approximately 140 miles from Rhineyville, Kentucky. KSP notified Brent's battalion commander about the murders, and they sent investigators to speak to Brent. The battalion commander told Burke's company commander to make the death notification. Burke was on patrol at the time, but he was called back to the office to perform some other duties. But, you know, the other duties was just a guise to not arouse any suspicions, and they wanted to be able to disarm Brent before informing him about the murder. The company commander called the chaplain to accompany him to the battalion conference room, where he planned to make the official death notification. After telling Burke about the death of his estranged wife and her former mother-in-law, Burke spent about an hour with the chaplain behind closed doors. While Burke and the chaplain were talking, two plainclothes KSP detectives and a uniformed trooper arrived at Fort Campbell to interview him. The two detectives questioned Burke in a conference room at the battalion for about 25 minutes before they all went back to Burke's barracks to let him gather some clothes to be more comfortable and continue the conversation. When they got back to the barracks, the detectives questioned Burke and his roommate separately. The roommate told KSP that Burke had returned to the barracks at approximately 11:30 p.m. the night before. Shortly after getting back there from work, Burke left again, and his roommate didn't see him until approximately 6:30 in the morning when the roommate returned from PT. This seems like interesting information for the detectives, considering that this left Burke without any real alibi for 7 hours from 11:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. So it's 140 miles from Rhineyville to Fort Campbell, so roughly a 2.5 hour drive one way. Round trip, that's 5 hours. Detectives surmise that was plenty of time for Burke to drive to the Comer's house, kill Tracy and Karen, then drive back to post and jump into bed before his roommate got back from PT. Brent answered questions for another 3 hours or so, and the entire thing was recorded. After hearing from Brent, detectives were pretty sure that Brent committed the murders. It wasn't that there was a confession, it was more about the contradicting statements that Brent made and the odd things that he claimed were his alibi. But the state didn't have any real evidence against Brent, so they let him go. In fact, he had been free to go the entire time he was talking to police. A few days after the murders, 9-year-old Matthew, who was the one who called 911, was interviewed by the KSP. He told them he didn't know who shot his mom and grandma, but he knew that they were wearing a camouflage jacket just like the one his stepdad owned. In fact, little Matthew had seen this exact jacket in his stepfather Brent's closet. Matthew described it as the old woodland BDU pattern, not the current, or at the time, the 2007, Army combat uniform. Matthew told detectives that he heard his stepdad's voice, but that it was kind of low, like he was trying to disguise it. When the shooting took place, Matthew hid in a closet with his little brother and sister for hours, and he stayed there for that long because he was too scared to come out because he didn't know if the intruder was still at the house. KSP investigators also interviewed 4-year-old Ian, who asked investigators if they were there to talk about how his daddy shot his mommy. Ian told detectives that he actually saw his dad shoot his mom. Investigators at the crime scene determined that the intruder used a 9mm handgun to shoot out the glass in the back door and also used the same 9mm to shoot and kill both Tracy and Karen. As investigators asked about any weapons in the home, they learned that Tracy's father, David Wilburn, had gifted Brent Burke a 9mm handgun 5 months before the murders. But Brent argued his father-in-law gifted him a .38, and he gave the gun to Tracy to keep for protection. Neither the 9mm murder weapon nor the alleged .38 gift were ever found. It wasn't a lot to go on, but the statements from the kids, coupled with some statements made by Tracy before her death, and the now missing gifted gun were enough to charge Brent Burke with 2 counts of murder. And the charges came on October 15th, 2007, over a month after the double homicide. Hi, everyone. For anyone who follows me on Instagram, I recently posted a picture of me with my kiddos at Disney in front of the Disney castle. But I posted it because my shoulders were looking on fire, defined, toned, and overall just pleasant to look at. So many of you asked me in my DMs for my secret. And of course, my secret is 4 a.m. workouts. But I get the oomph to wake up at 4 a.m. and work out from my pre-workout drink called Energy Explosion. My pre-workout powder was created by world-renowned fitness guru Natalia Melofit. I have been following Natalia for many years now. And in fact, after my second C-section, I hired her as my fitness trainer. And she also helped me postpartum with my third C-section as well. So when she came out with a pre-workout supplement that didn't cause any of the jitters and the crashing, I knew I needed to try it. Energy Explosion helps with energy, and it keeps me going all through the morning hours. Because I take it first thing in the morning, which is when I choose to work out, I no longer require that morning cup of joe. This pre-workout has nootropic ingredients which significantly help me personally with mental clarity and focus. Which, listen, when you're juggling what feels like hundreds of tasks a day, it truly does help. And guess what? My listeners are getting 15% off your order. What? Yes, please. If you're ready to get the pump without the jitters, visit mbodysup.com and enter my code MAMAMARGO at checkout for 15% off your order. That's M as in Mike, body, sup as in Sierra Uniform Papa Papa .com. Add Energy Explosion to your cart and use my code MAMAMARGO, that's MAMAMARGOT, for 15% off. Enjoy, and when you use it, please DM me so we can talk about your workouts. Sergeant Brent Burke was obsessed with following in his father's footsteps as a soldier since he was a young boy. Brent grew up in a farm in Ursa, Illinois, and it was in early 2001 while stationed in White Sands in New Mexico that Brent met Tracy. Tracy was working as a nurse and she was a single mom when they met. After her divorce was final from Michael Pete, her and Brent were married. But Tracy's family recalled that Brent was overly obsessed with Tracy, so much so that her dad had to tell him to cut it out and let her breathe. In any event, the couple went on to have 2 kids together. Ian was 4 years old and their little girl Reagan was 2 at the time of Tracy's death. While at Fort Campbell, Brent was a part of the 101st Airborne Division, and he had deployed a few times. It was during his last deployment to Afghanistan that Tracy really began to work on herself, and during his year and some change away, Tracy lost a whopping 60 pounds. She was now trim and more confident, and she even went out and purchased herself a Camaro. Brent did not want to get divorced, but it appeared that once he returned from Afghanistan, Tracy had made up her mind. The couple was constantly fighting about money, and 48 Hours reported that there was one incident where Brent basically picked up little Matthew and body slammed him in front of other family members. Little Matthew cried while Brent played it off that he was just being dramatic. This incident did not sit well with Tracy. Once Tracy initiated the divorce proceedings, her and the kids were taken in by her former in-laws, and Brent was ordered to live in the barracks. Before her death, Tracy told her stepmom that she didn't think Brent would actually let her divorce him. She said she was afraid that he was actually going to kill her. And then, after her death, came the realization that the divorce was 4 days shy of being finalized at the time she was murdered. So let's go through the many trials of Brent Burke. His case was being tried by the state of Kentucky, and initially, they were seeking the death penalty. Brent Burke faced his first trial in September of 2009 with the death penalty looming as the punishment. Brent's attorney was prepared to fight the charge, but at trial, the defense learned that the state failed to inform them that another human being had admitted to the double homicide. What? Yes. While Brent sat in jail awaiting trial, a teen girl called authorities to let them know her boyfriend, 14-year-old Deshaun White, had confessed to the double murder as part of a gang initiation. Deshaun White had also told some other friends the same exact story. When authorities caught up with Deshaun, he recanted and said he just made up the entire story basically to look tough to his friends. Seeing no other connection between Deshaun White and the double homicide of Tracy Burke and Karen Comer, authorities crossed Deshaun off as a suspect. But the prosecution failed to provide this potentially exculpatory evidence to the defense, and the judge declared a mistrial. This mistrial, though, did not deter the state. In January of 2009, the second trial got underway. This time, the prosecution's star witness, young Matthew Peet, got sick and required emergency surgery. Due to his inability to testify at trial, the judge declared a second mistrial. Trial number three started in August of 2010. The prosecution decided to drop their pursuit of the death penalty, and instead, they were asking for life in prison. At this trial, Deshaun White took the stand to basically say that his initial confession to his friends was fake and done simply for attention. He denied any involvement in the murders. Tracy's two young sons both testified in front of their father and stepfather. Matthew gave his ear witness account of hearing what he thought was Brent's voice, although he said it was lower than normal. And Matthew explained that it was like Brent was trying to disguise his voice. Matthew was confident and articulate and pointed Brent out as the person he heard in the house the night his mother and grandmother were killed. The defense argued that Matthew and Ian's confidence in what they heard had developed over the course of 3 years while being coached by Tracy's family. They pointed out that when Matthew had first been interviewed by KSP, Matthew said he wasn't sure what he heard that night. Michelle Kerstetter, Karen Comer's daughter, said that Ian didn't need to be coached because he said it all the time, quote, "My daddy killed my mommy," end quote. And she said those were his words, not theirs. The prosecution pointed out that Brent had motive and opportunity to kill his estranged wife, but all the evidence was circumstantial. There was no DNA, no smoking gun. In fact, there was no gun at all. And with a purely circumstantial case, the jury could not reach a unanimous decision. They ended in a hung jury, and a mistrial was declared. After yet another mistrial, Brent Burke went on a public affairs campaign trying to make himself look good in the public's eye. He said in an interview with the CBS affiliate that, quote, "I only got 10 minutes, so I just want to make a statement. I'm an innocent man. I can no longer sit back and be railroaded and slandered. As of now, I've lost my children and my career. What more does the Commonwealth of Kentucky want from an innocent man? I was 2 hours and 40 minutes away from the crime scene. Now, I'm not a genius by any means, but just a soldier and a father. But if the time don't fit, you must acquit. I'm a father and I'm a soldier and I need to go home to my family," end quote. What in the O.J. Simpson is this guy trying to say here? The time does fit. You had 7 hours and it's only a 5-hour round trip drive. Come on, man. Kentucky was not giving up. The fourth trial got underway and the prosecution brought out everything they had, leaning heavily on the timeline of when Burke was last seen on Fort Campbell by his roommate. And let's not forget the 7-hour gap in time where he could not verify his whereabouts. I mean, honestly, I wish the prosecution would have started opening statements by starting with that recording of Brent saying,
"But if the time don't fit, you must acquit."
And then they could have walked them through how Brent could have rode his bike to commit the murders and still had time to stop at 7-Eleven for a Slurpee. Anyway, the prosecution pointed out that Burke was last seen at 11:30 p.m. on Fort Campbell, and police believe the murders took place at around 3 a.m. Then he was seen by his roommate sleeping in his bunk at 6:30 a.m. Testimony from KSP detectives showed that when Brent Burke was first notified on base that Tracy and Karen had been murdered, he was interviewed at the battalion headquarters and in the barracks. Burke told detectives that after getting back to his room after his shift as an MP, he left the barracks and drove to put gas in the van, and that was at about 1 o'clock in the morning of September 11th. Of note, Burke told investigators that he used his debit card to pay for the gas, but there was no activity on his debit card during the time he claimed he got gas. Burke then claimed that after he gassed up the van, he went truck shopping. Apparently, he did his truck shopping at about 2 to 2:30 a.m. because he couldn't sleep and he really didn't like salespeople. Okay, buddy, what are the odds that you are out stalking trucks at 2 a.m. the same day that your wife, who believed you would kill her before divorcing her, ended up dead? Anyway, let's continue. Then Burke told the investigators that he went back to Fort Campbell after going truck shopping and fell asleep in his car because it was too hot in the barracks room, and he didn't go back into his room until 6 a.m., and that's why his room didn't see him when he got up to go to PT, but saw him when he got back. Brent also told KSP that he sat in his car drinking energy drinks all night long. Okay, so you're probably wondering why I didn't start this episode with this statement by Burke. Well, the thing about this interview and all the idiotic things that he said during it is that the jury never heard a single word of this interview. You want to take a gander as to why? Because Brent was never Mirandized. You know the whole "you have the right to remain silent, anything you say can and will be used against you" spiel? Yep, they never did it. So the civilian judge did not allow this statement to come in as evidence. It was considered inadmissible at trial. But wait, at this fourth trial, the defense found a witness that really jacked up the prosecution's timeline. Remember, the prosecution believed that double murder occurred at around 3 a.m., which gave Brent plenty of time to get off work and drive down to Rineyville and commit the crime. Well, the defense found a witness by the name of Mark Gilmartin, who was one of the Comers' neighbors. Mark was out walking his dog at about 10 p.m. on September 10th. He testified that while he was walking his dog, he heard 4 to 5 gunshots and the sound of a dog yelping. And you might recall that Matthew said that the dog had also been shot. So the defense was now arguing that the murders probably occurred at 10 p.m. when Brent was still working. But as reported in the 48 Hours episode on this case, at the time he heard the gunshots, Mark Gilmartin was not alarmed and he didn't rush to call the cops. You see, the neighborhood was located near a firing range and hearing gunshots at that hour was not out of the norm. But the gunshots and the dog yelping did create at least some reasonable doubt for the jurors. Yet another hit to the prosecution came from a forensic specialist who testified that the lab was unable to conclusively identify fingerprints taken from 5 shell casings found at the scene. And they were unable to positively match the prints due to the samples being too small to properly analyze. The lab had also analyzed blood on a t-shirt and towel that belonged to Deshaun White, but the blood was determined not to belong to either Karen Comer or Tracy Burke. Which kind of floors me that they were still bringing up evidence from Deshaun, considering that he had recanted multiple times and there was no further connection. But it was a smart move by the defense to keep bringing this kid up, because all of us regular people wonder why would anyone ever confess to a double homicide they did not commit. Other forensic evidence included tiny shards of glass that were found on the floor mat of Burke's van. The forensic analyst had determined that the samples were too small to identify them as a match to the shattered door at the Comer home. Now, I just want to make sure Brent Burke is the same person. So sometimes I refer to him as Brent. Sometimes I refer to him as Burke. It's the same guy. It's the sergeant from Fort Campbell. After all the testimony and evidence presentations, this jury deliberated for 4.5 hours, but came back deadlocked again. The judge sent them back and said, "Keep going. Try to come towards a common decision." But they couldn't agree on a verdict. And after another hour, they came back to the courtroom and they wanted to hear some evidence again. They heard 2.5 hours of testimony repeated back to them. They also asked to see testimony from about a half dozen people. Then they went back to deliberate. But by 8 p.m. that night, they were still hopelessly deadlocked. The judge asked if they thought further deliberation would help them get to a unanimous decision. But they couldn't. They just sat there in silence until the judge relented and a fourth mistrial was called. After the fourth failed attempt to prosecute Sergeant Brent Burke, the prosecutor Chris Shaw dropped all charges against Brent. Let me say that again. After 4 years and 4 failed trials, The state of Kentucky was dropping all charges against Brent Burke without prejudice. Brent said in an interview that as soon as he was released, he was going to fight for his job back, meaning he was going to fight to be an MP in the Army. He also said, quote, God willing, I will get to visit my children, end quote. Young Matthew Pete wasn't happy about the news. After the end of the fourth trial, Matthew was now 12 years old, and he knew that if his former stepfather was free, he could come back and kill him in revenge. Burke was released as a free man to Fort Campbell, but was restricted to base. What Brent Burke didn't know was that the Army Judge Advocate General Corps, aka the JAG Corps, had been talking with the KSP, and they were now looking into the charges. 9 days after his release, Burke was detained by Fort Campbell CID and charged by the Army with murder. Burke was brought in for questioning and properly advised of his rights. The investigator questioning Burke told him that he didn't think Burke went to Rhineyville on September 11th with the intent to kill Tracy. He thought her murder wasn't premeditated. But Burke retorted, saying, "You're right, I wasn't there." The agent was pissed. He retorted, "No, you were there, Brent. Don't freaking lie to me, man. You lied to the state guys, okay? Like I said, I'm a freaking federal agent. You lie to me, and now you're playing a game that's going to just start stacking up charges against you," end quote. Sergeant Brent Burke was charged with murder under the UCMJ. The military was able to bring charges against Burke because, as you might recall, Burke was on active duty at the time of the murders. And the state didn't drop the charges because they thought Burke was innocent. No, they had tried and failed 4 times. With that, a 5th trial, a general court-martial, got underway. As is the choice of the member facing court-martial, Burke had to decide between a jury consisting of enlisted and officer members or just of officer members. And he chose the latter and went with 7 senior officers to sit on the panel, which is what a jury is known as in military courts. Burke's charges were as follows: 2 specifications of premeditated murder, felony murder, burglary, 3 specifications of child endangerment, and obstruction of justice. The big thing to remember in military trials is that the verdict doesn't need to be unanimous, unless, of course, the military is pursuing the death penalty, which they were not in this case. Another thing to know is that the defendant known as the accused in a military court can present what they call good soldier evidence. By the way, this information is for court-martials of old, as the good soldier defense is no longer admissible for serious crimes any longer. But since it was available for this trial, you know, back in the early 2010s, let's talk about it. The good soldier defense allows the accused to present evidence of their military accomplishments, and the panel, aka the jury, can weigh that information in their decision of guilt or innocence. The trial got underway with the prosecutors presenting testimony from friends and relatives that painted Brent Burke as a controlling figure who didn't want to grant Tracy a divorce because, one, he didn't want to give up control of the finances, he didn't want to give up control of the decisions, and he sure as heck didn't want Tracy moving the kids away from him. Matthew and Ian both testified about the night their mom was murdered. Matthew told 48 Hours that Brent Burke glared at him during his testimony. So little Matthew, being the little baddie that he is, said that he glared back at his former stepfather. During the 4 civilian trials, all the evidence presented against Burke was circumstantial. They didn't have any physical evidence tying Burke to the crime scene. However, the Army's Criminal Investigation Laboratory was able to locate a microscopic piece of glass on Burke's coat. The lab compared the glass to shattered glass taken from the back door of the Comer's home and found that it was similar in nature to the glass found on Burke's coat. Now, I said similar in nature because they didn't say it was like 100% match, but it was similar. It was the first piece of physical evidence that prosecutors could present to the jury. The problem was they found the glass on Brent Burke's gray digital camouflage ACU jacket. The testimony from Matthew and Ian was that they saw someone in a BDU jacket, the battle dress uniform, which is green, brown, and black. However, the prosecution argued that the glass could have gotten on the ACU jacket through transference. Since this was a military court, the rulings were a bit different from state court. Remember the inadmissible original statement by Burke? The military panel was able to hear Burke's entire statement. Remember when he got gas at 1 a.m. and went truck shopping at 2 a.m.? Yes. The military jury heard it all. After just 8 days, all the testimony and arguments were done, and the panel was ready to deliberate. They deliberated for 2.5 hours, and they found Brent Burke guilty. Sentencing in this case was particularly easy because Brent Burke would get life in prison. But the question remained, would he be eligible for parole or not? Burke's family pleaded for leniency, citing his strong family ties and crime-free life up until that point. The panel, though, they weren't having it. They sentenced Burke to life without parole. But as you know, with all military court-martials, that wasn't all of the business at hand. They also ordered that he be dishonorably discharged, that he forfeit all pay and allowances, that he receive a reprimand, and that he be reduced in rank to E1. The convening authority credited Burke with 1,676 days of confinement, which really doesn't matter because he's not eligible for parole anyway. Burke was initially incarcerated at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, but the Bureau of Prisons inmate locator shows that as of today, Brent Burke, now 46 years old, is at the U.S. State Prison in Tucson, a high-security U.S. penitentiary. Recently, I covered two unsolved cases, which I am sure caused you to pause and analyze your inner detective. Well, if you want to hone in on that inner detective, then you need to check out June's Journey. June's Journey is a mobile game that you can play anywhere while connected to Wi-Fi. June's Journey takes you through the main character, June's, adventure to uncover family secrets. Her first task is to uncover the mystery of her sister's death. You will be using your keen eye to spot hidden clues in the immersive scenes that take you across the globe. The scene is set in the 1920s, so it's like going back in time. June's Journey is a hidden object mystery game, and I love playing while waiting for my kids at the bus stop. It allows me to clear my mind from the tasks of the day and to refocus on my mommy duties. What I love about June's Journey is that not only are you searching for objects, but you can join other players online in a detective club. And then you also get to design this luxurious island estate that is all yours. And if you have friends who play, you can gift each other trees, flowers, and other amazing decorative items. Today, I invite you to escape reality and immerse yourself in the world of June Parker. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Go ahead, download June's Journey today. Brent Burke appealed his military conviction on February in 2015, and the first thing he appealed was the trial judge's ruling on allowing Burke's entire police statement to come in as evidence. Burke argued that it was inadmissible because they failed to read him his rights. Yeah, Miranda doesn't really apply in the military, but its equivalent, Article 31 rights, those do apply and those weren't read either. The United States Army Court of Criminal Appeals, though, they determined that the recorded questioning was lawfully obtained in the eyes of the military law. First of all, Brent Burke was not under arrest at the time, nor was he detained by the KSP detectives prior to questioning. In fact, you might recall he was questioned on September 11th, and he wasn't arrested until mid-October. At no time was Burke interrogated by his chain of command. He was never told that he was required to stay, he was free to leave, and he never once objected to speaking with the civilian officers. Burke openly participated and even voluntarily provided the location of his divorce decree for the officers. So, point one was denied. The second appeal point was concerning the location and atmosphere of the interview with KSP. The appeals court pointed out that Burke was in a building, the MP battalion headquarters, that contained an actual interrogation room, but he was never questioned in the interrogation room. He was in a big conference room with windows, a conference table, and chairs, and he could go freely whenever he wanted. He ate a meal while sitting there in the conference room, and they allowed him to drive himself back to his barracks room. The appeals court did not buy into the thought that being in the place where he was living would be a stressful environment. So point two was also denied. The last appeal point was concerning the length of questioning, which was in total about 3 hours. The appeals court again found that the KSP interview, that the length and all of it was proper. Burke was allowed to take as many breaks as he needed. He was allowed to walk around freely, and he even made phone calls. So point three was denied. The appellate court determined that since Burke was not in custody, there were no inherently compelling pressures with which Miranda was concerned. The questioning was completely voluntary, and during the questioning, Burke let the detectives know that he was familiar with the investigative process. After all, he was a military police officer. Bottom line, there was no reason to receive Miranda warnings because Burke was not in custody. His statements were voluntary and properly admitted into evidence. But Burke's attorney also argued that the charge of felony murder was unreasonably multiplicious with respect to the murder charge for the same victim and the burglary charge. Basically, they argued that Burke was charged twice for murder for killing Karen Comer. The court agreed with the appeal motion and dismissed the additional charge and specification. The verdict on that specific charge was set aside, but the remaining findings of guilt were affirmed, and it did not warrant a change to the sentence of life without parole. So there was a civil federal suit in this case. I want to talk about the Federal Tort Claims Act, or FTCA. The FTCA was enacted in 1946, providing a means for people to sue the government in federal court. A tort is an act or omission that causes harm to persons or property. Tracy and Karen's family members, they filed a wrongful death claim through the FTCA because Brent Burke was an active duty soldier at the time of the murders, and the military failed to basically keep these two members of society safe. The family claimed that the Army didn't provide any warnings that Burke posed a danger to them, nor did the Army act to protect them from him. Initially, the district court granted a motion by the government to dismiss the claim, but that decision was later overturned, meaning that initially the Army filed a motion to dismiss the case and it was dismissed, but then it was brought back. The court opinion that this information came from concerns the tort claim and the Army's failure to provide those warnings and protection. The evidence presented indicated that Burke began showing violent tendencies as early as 2005 while he was deployed to Egypt. During that deployment, members of the platoon noted that Burke was extremely upset about his marriage. At one point, Burke told his platoon leader, Lieutenant Perez, that he would kill himself, kill Tracy, or both if Tracy ever left him. Because of this statement and other similar statements made by Burke to other members of his platoon, his leadership confiscated Burke's weapons and placed him under the supervision of other soldiers. Burke also indirectly threatened his lieutenant, Lieutenant Perez, telling another soldier that he had found the perfect spot to murder the LT. Because of that threat, the Army yanked Burke from the platoon and redeployed him back to Fort Campbell for mental health counseling. Back at Fort Campbell, Burke received prescription medication and counseling to help him control his anger, depression, and other psychological disorders he was experiencing. While still on medication for his anger and depression, the Army returned Burke to duty and deployed him to Afghanistan, where he worked as a detention center guard at Bagram Air Base. It was there that the Army observed Burke continuing to behave violently. They eventually removed him from duty again because he repeatedly expressed his hatred of the detainees and in an unauthorized manner deployed a can of OC Fogger on some of the detainees. I had to look it up and it's basically military equivalent pepper spray. After Burke was redeployed, he moved back into his off-base house with his wife and kids. On May 26, 2007, 3 months before the murders, police were called to Burke's house after Burke tried to physically keep Tracy from moving out of their house and in with the Comers. Local law enforcement notified Burke's chain of command after that call. The Army investigated the incident under a written internal policy titled Policy 7, Command Response to Incidents of Domestic Violence. This policy basically requires unit commanders to respond to credible reports of domestic violence. In response to this one, the Army ordered a 72-hour cooling-off period and ordered Burke to attend counseling and social services sessions. His privately owned weapons were marked as confiscated, but they weren't actually confiscated. Following the incident, Brent and Tracy physically separated and Tracy filed for divorce. Burke moved into the barracks. While in the barracks, soldiers are actually required to register and store any privately owned weapons in the unit arms room. But no one from Burke's chain of command checked to see if Burke had ever done either. The following month, in June of 2007, Tracy told Brent's leadership that she was scared of Brent and that she was worried that he had access to weapons. At that time, she also requested a protective order to keep her estranged husband away from her. Also in June of 2007, Burke told another soldier that, quote, "I'm going to shoot that b-." Quote, he was going to take her into the woods and shoot her, end quote. The soldier immediately reported the threats to Burke's supervisor, but the supervisor dismissed them, saying that Burke was just, quote, "blowing off steam." How sad is that? Another domestic violence incident took place on August 11th, 2007, exactly a month before the murders. The police were called and the Army was notified of the incident. However, the Army did not conduct an investigation under their Policy 7, and they didn't take Burke's guns or refer him for more counseling. After that, and I literally am heartbroken that they failed Tracy in this, but Burke told yet another soldier that he would be better off if his wife was dead. A sergeant, Jonathan Dean, not in Burke's chain of command, saw that Burke was extremely agitated and decided that he didn't think Burke needed to have a weapon in his agitated state. So this soldier did the right thing. He took Burke's privately owned 9mm pistol away out of concern for Tracy, and because he knew that it was against Army regulations for Brent to store the gun in his vehicle or in the barracks room anyway. On August 31st, 2007, Burke talked Dean into giving him his 9mm back for, quote, "recreational use." Dean complied and gave it back to him on September 1st. 10 days later, Tracy Burke and Karen Comer were dead from gunshot wounds consistent with coming from a 9mm gun. Brent's gun, MIA. Never to be seen again. These were all grounds in which Tracy and Karen's family filed under the Federal Torts Claim Act. Well, the Federal Appeals Court reversed a district court decision to dismiss the tort claim and remanded the case back to the district court so the families could proceed with their case. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find the outcome of the tort claim, but the facts section of the opinion was very helpful in informing this episode. In the years after the murders, Michelle Kerstetter, Kurt and Karen Comer's daughter, made sure that her children remembered their grandmother, especially at Christmas and on special occasions. She recalled her mom's selflessness when she was stationed in Korea in the 1990s. Karen left her job and stayed home to take care of Michelle's kids. Michelle wore her uniform to Brent Burke's court-martial. At the time, she was a chief master sergeant in the Air National Guard. As of 2017, Kurt Comer was still living in the dream house that he and Karen built together in Rineyville. Kurt passed away at the age of 70. Kurt served his country in the U.S. Army as a drill sergeant and as a cavalry scout in Vietnam and during the Gulf War, and retired as a sergeant first class. After his career in the Army, he worked as a long-haul truck driver. According to his obituary, he was a proud veteran who never lost his military discipline and the patriotism that the Army instilled in him. Karen Comer is remembered for her distinct laugh, her love of animals, and how she loved to sit in her backyard and watch birds come and go from the feeder. She loved to cook from scratch. Karen was known as kind-hearted and caring. If she had something and you needed it, it became yours, including her home. Her kindness and huge heart were evident when she took in a former daughter-in-law and her three kids, two that weren't even blood related to Karen. She was also a huge fan of The Young and the Restless. Michael Pete, who is Karen's son, Matthew's father, and Tracy's ex-husband, had just returned from a deployment to Iraq when he got the news about the murders from his father. He knew his and his son's lives would never be the same again. He told the news enterprise that his mother's murder isn't the dominant memory he has of Karen. He said, quote, "The feeling of being loved by my mom is by far my overarching memory of her. I think about my mom multiple times a day, every single day. I miss her," end quote. Vanessa Pete, Michael's wife, said that because she and Michael were stationed in Washington State, she didn't meet Karen until the week before their wedding. Despite their short introduction, she knew that Karen had a big heart and a love for all. On the 10-year anniversary of the double murder, she told the news enterprise, quote, "You don't just get over the fact that someone decided to kill someone you love in cold blood," end quote. Karen's obituary included the names of all 10 of her grandchildren. The list included, of course, Matthew Pete, but it also listed Ian and Reagan Burke. They were not her grandchildren by blood, but it speaks volumes to the depth of her ability to love. Matthew Peet was honored with a Hero Award in September of 2015 for his bravery in calling 911. He got to meet the KSB dispatcher that took the tragic call from him when he was only 9 years old. Matthew said that he wanted his angels to know how much he appreciated them. He said, quote, "I can't thank you enough to them. They helped me and I am very honored to be in their presence," end quote. In an article from 2017, 10 years after the murders, Matthew was still going to therapy once a week to help him cope with the trauma of the night his mother and grandmother were killed. He said, quote, "That not only has helped me work through emotional instabilities, but also has enhanced my ability to process everything else that comes my way. I try my best to be a positive, radiant member of my community, whether that be at work, at school, or at home with family," end quote. In 2017, Matthew Peet was 19 years old. He was a full-time college student and working 30 hours a week at the same time. He said, quote, "My best memory occurred almost weekly, but truly described who she was. Quote, after my brother and sister would lie down for nap time, my mother would make sure to bring out a board game, whether it was Life, my favorite, Clue, or her favorite, Trivial Pursuit, and I believe it's where I get a lot of the random facts I know," end quote. Matthew also said that honoring their lives with how he lives is of utmost importance to him. Quote, "About as important as it is to live life, I can't be either of them. It's physically impossible for me to reach that level of compassion and selflessness that they possessed, but I try my best to be the best human being I can, as they did," end quote. Isn't that amazing how this little boy was able to come through that? I hope that he keeps that energy forever. Tracy Burke is very much missed by her three children and the rest of her family. Thank you so much, True Crime Army, for joining me this week for another episode of Military Murder. My apologies that this episode was posted late. Shout out to all my new patrons and Apple Premium subscribers. I appreciate you supporting the show. For all my listeners, if you're interested in more content and also looking into ways to support the show, head on over to patreon.com/militarymurder or check out my Apple Premium subscription to check for more content. Thank you as always to Myrtle for researching and writing this episode. The sources for this episode include a court-martial appellate opinion, a Sixth Circuit court opinion, and articles found in CBS News, WDRB News, newspapers.com, the Bureau of Prisons website, and findagrave.com. I also relied on a 48 hours episode on this case. Military Murder was created by Mama Margot Productions. This month's executive producers are Falcon 13, Myrtle, and Jen. This month's newest associate producers are Chike and Tanya. This month's newest assistant producer is Christina. The music was created by Tyops. Until next time, remember, you never really know what someone is capable of, so remain vigilant always. You have a fabulous week, and I'll keep digging to bring you another Military Murder story next week.
Mama's working on her podcast.